It was interesting going through her things after her passing, finding a multi-page letter written to conference officials, arguing the benefits of Pastor Glenn and how they dare not do anything negative with regard to him. And I just so much appreciate Point Loma and what you've meant to her, what this community has been to her. You know, it's for us as kids, it seems like just yesterday that she tucked us into bed and said goodnight to us in the upstairs bedroom of our Talmadge room, or our house in Talmadge, you know. It was just yesterday that we were eagerly tearing off wrapping paper from Christmas gifts that she lovingly placed under the tree. It was just yesterday that either she or Dad would call worship time, and we'd all rush into the living room and we'd jump pile on to the ugly, stylish 70s era green couch. Or was it 60s? And we'd snuggle up to Mom and Dad as we were read bedtime stories and Bible stories. And you know, looking back, I remember, I mean, you have to understand, I think most of you can relate. When you're a kid, your parents seem ageless. Looking back now, I realize how young they were. They were just young adults with a passion for creating this warm, nurturing home of safety for their children. And yet, both of them were handicapped. My dad knew nothing about treating a woman. My mother didn't even have a dad growing up. In fact, my grandmother had been working as a maid in someone's home, married couple's home, and something happened, and my mother was born. And yet I have to say, what a blessed accident. But I assume that for her, growing up with a mom filled with guilt and shame was difficult. And that it was a major challenge for my grandmother to put food on their table, much less a roof over their head. When they got to Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island, they're living in a home without hot water. They have to go downstairs to a dirt floor basement with rats running around, to fight with other tenants to use the one restroom that was available for all of them in that building. That's what my mom grew up in. And yet at the age of 10, something happened that would forever change her life. Her grandmother's sister, Mary, both my grandmother and her sister were full-blood Jewish. But Mary had been studying the Bible with a Seventh-day Adventist and had come to the conclusion that she would embrace and accept the one promised by the Hebrew prophets. And so it was at the age of 10 that my mother was baptized with her own mother into the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And that was a life-changing event, and not just because it was a spiritual thing, but statistics prove, and this is weird, statistically, if a person becomes a Seventh-day Adventist, they increase socioeconomically. Strange. And yet I think I know why that happens. Because there is such a focus on education. Education is so important. I saw my mom inspire kids, and I know you probably do this as well, where students are wondering, can I really make it in the big wide world out there? Is it really worth it to struggle? And there were people that came around and said, Sally, you've got to put Jeannie in school. You've got to get her in school. What about South Lancaster Academy? I know it costs money, but look, we'll come up with the money. The church is behind you. There are people that will donate. And so my mother went to South Lancaster, went to Atlantic Union College, graduated with a degree in English. Then she got a job in Madera, California, of all of the godforsaken, dry, barren places on the planet. But that's where she met my dad, and they moved to Ukiah. And she taught school there for a year or two until I came along. And after the marriage to my father ended, she moved down here. And you know what she did? She went back to school. I think it was San Diego State for her master's in English. She began teaching all over. But of course, in early 2004 or 2005, that wasn't good enough. She wanted her doctorate. And she spent hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars, flew back and forth to and from here to San Diego, to Pennsylvania, completed all of her research, wrote the entire dissertation, but somebody a little higher in the food chain decided that one chapter wasn't good enough and that she needed to rewrite it. Ironically, her dissertation focused on helping teachers not to superimpose their own personalities on their students. And when she couldn't complete the deadline, because I think she had a hospitalization or something, they cut her off. And of course, she was disappointed. We all were. But you know what? More important than letters behind her name on a course roster, like PhD, was the legacy that she left behind in the hearts and lives of those that knew her. And as I'm hearing it, I know some of us here have been profoundly blessed and even influenced. She's listened. She spent time. I know personally that she's given away tens of thousands of dollars. Where she got that, I don't know. But she just loved to give. I remember one time in San Francisco going through Union Square. No, Mom, no. And the vultures are hovering, looking for handouts. And I'm like, no. But she remembered what it was like to be in those shoes. And she said, I'm going to help. I know some of you have probably sat in her classes, maybe. Some of you have been inspired to dream big, aim high. And I know that as her children, we will always carry a part of her with us. Whether it's an ability to listen, a love for music, or an ability to craft words into sentences that inspire imagination. And I know this personally because she was my first teacher. She taught me how to read going through the phonics course. Can you say Freddy the frog? And I learned how to read. She inspired me with a love for literature. But it wasn't just secular. This was my mom that taught me to love this book. And she taught me how to pray. And that there was a great big God up there that loved little boys and girls. And it was particularly shocking and discouraging for her when her firstborn decided that there was no God and that this book was a bunch of fables. Now, she didn't know the journey that I took back until later. In brief, what happened to me is I had to ask, wait a second, how do I know that there's a God? Well, I've had personal experiences with Him. There are things I can't explain. And then when I look around and I see a hovering hummingbird or the beauty in a rose garden, everything around me screams design, and design begs for, at least to my mind, it begged for a designer. And then this book talked about a great big God, and I immediately had a roadblock, and I thought, how do you know this book? I mean, everybody's got their own book, their religious book. And there were five things that I encountered. First of all, you know that this book is a collection of 66 different books written by 40 different authors over a period of 1,500 years. And these different authors all agree on the nature of God, on what's important in life, what's fulfilling. Try to get two secular historians to agree on a 10-year period of history. Secondly, what blew me away was I would read stories here of things that happened in the past. And believe it or not, they were confirmed, many of them, by secular history. Third, I was blown away. Well, I started studying archaeology. I was blown away. Almost every time an archaeologist digs in the Middle East, they would come up with, and these are skeptics, and they would say things like, it's very likely or possible that this was the personal seal of the queen called Jezebel in the Bible. And I'd get chills up and down my spine. But then beyond that, next I would go in here and I would find predictions where the Bible would step out on a limb and make detailed, specific predictions, and they would come true. In fact, I could regale you for the next 4 hours, I won't, on archaeological discoveries and prophecies that do just that. And of course, I saw changed lives. All of these things were important to me as Jean's son. But she didn't need them. This book was an immense source of comfort and hope. I know, because I was with her on the last day that she was alive, just hours before she went. And you have to understand my mom. She was recuperating. She had been up walking until she got tired. She'd been trying to sit up in bed and pay bills online. And I'm sure looking back now that she had been worrying about the future. She had a lot to think about. Just 12 weeks prior, she had been gallivanting all over the San Diego Basin as Professor Knittel from college to college. And all of a sudden, she's in a place now where she had had to think, wait a second. Do I continue to teach at the age of 81? And that decision was agony for her because that meant, I mean, she loved rubbing shoulders with students. This is a woman who had conversant conversations with students about something called Tinder. The only thing I know about Tinder is something I don't want to share. But she knew about that. She loved her colleagues and connecting with them. And she loved this church and this community and her friends. She didn't want to leave them, her neighbors. And then on top of that, she knew that she couldn't afford to keep her house. She would have to sell it. We had started to move. What do you sell? What do you keep? And then on top of that, she was not feeling well. And she just said at one point, I mean, she'd been really quiet and resting. I was about ready to go up to the hospital cafeteria and grab a bite to eat. And my mom said, Marlon, can you come sit here next to me? You know what she wanted me to do? Read out of this book. And I'm like a deer in the headlights. I understand being a pastor to other people, but this is mom, you know, it's a little different. And she said, isn't there a place in the Bible that says, I will never leave you or forsake you? So I found it. And I read it, one and then another passage, and until finally the worry had dissipated and she was calm and she smiled and she said, Marlon, you must be really hungry. Why don't you go get something to eat? And I did. This book brought her a lot of comfort. And you know, one of the most comforting passages in the book, it's a story, brief story, is something that gives me great hope. It's a story written by an eyewitness. One of Jesus' friends was a guy by the name of Lazarus. In John chapter 11, he had two sisters that sent word to Jesus while he was in northern Israel, saying, look, the guy that you love is sick. And by the time Jesus decided to come back down there, he told his disciples. You got to hear what he said. Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I'm going to go wake him up. Well, any of you who have ever been sick know that if you're sick, it's hard to sleep. But when you start getting the ability to sleep back, you're getting better. They're thinking, you're going to wake this guy up. He's just starting to get better. And finally, Jesus had to say, wait a second. No. You don't understand my metaphor here. Lazarus is dead. I'm going to go wake him up. And what's so profound to me about this? Jesus bypassed the two prevailing philosophical opinions about death in his time. There was one held by the ancient Greeks that said, when you die, your body disintegrates and all of the bodily problems and pleasures are over. Just the spirit that goes on. On the other hand, there was a whole group of people, including some of his own, that said, when you die, it's lights out, end of the tunnel, curtains, no mas. Jesus said, no, you don't understand. Death is like going to sleep on a sunny afternoon, waking up 3 hours later and saying, wow, what time is it? Where am I? Boy, do I feel good. That's how Jesus looked at death. And Jesus was the one that called it a sleep, a rest. But he also said, I'm the one that, he said, I wanted to wake him up. And this is significant because what I found is it's not so much what you know, but who you know. I was on my way home from church one afternoon in my dad's car as a teenager. I got pulled over because I had no registration tags on the back license plate. The officer, all businesslike, strides up to my window. License, registration, your name. You know why I pulled you over? He takes those, he heads back to his cruiser. Halfway back, he does a double take, swivels back around, and heads back to the car with an entire different demeanor. Wait a second, this says it's registered to Orlando Knittle. Are you Orlando's kid? I said, yes, officer. Oh, Orlando's a friend of mine. What's with the tags? I said, oh, they're probably on the kitchen table. Well, you tell him Joe said hi and make sure he gets those tags on. And it's the same way here. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And Martha encountered this when Jesus gets to the outskirts of Bethany, where Lazarus had been sick and buried. Martha comes running up to him and said, Lord, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died. Martha had seen lepers get healed, lame people walk, blind people see. She knew that people got healed around Jesus. And Jesus said, well, your brother will rise again. Martha is thinking, yeah, I know what you've taught us. Yes, I agree. I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. Jesus said to her, Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. Those words send a chill up and down my spine. Because when death comes, it seems so final. But there is one whose voice wakes the dead. And a little while later, Jesus makes his way to the outskirts of that little town where Lazarus is buried. He tells Martha, take away the stone from the tomb. Martha comes unglued. Excuse me, it's been 4 days. He doesn't smell very good by this time. Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you had faith, you would see the power of God? All right, all right. She gets her friends. They roll away the stone. And I can imagine the onlookers crowding around, or at least positioning themselves so they could see into that narrow, dark opening. And perhaps the light fell just right on that little shelf on which Lazarus had been laying and his body wrapped in linen. Jesus prays a short little prayer, looks into, and this was by somebody who witnessed it, John, one of his youngest disciples. Jesus looks into there and says, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus, who was dead, wakes up, gets up, stands up, and walks out. Wow. That's the one that my mother knew. Because it's not what you know, it's who you know. In fact, I know that this was my mother's hope, because going through her papers before she died. Oh, any of you have been through this process before of going through a loved one's effects? You know the challenges of that. I came across a half-finished essay written about the death of 4 of her friends back in 1985, I believe. They had been coming home from a women's retreat up in Sacramento area. And there had been a terrible car accident. One of those that had died was Edith Neufeld. My mother wrote these words. This is the first time I actually saw this. I had never seen this before. Yesterday I walked, this is what she's writing, yesterday I walked past Edith's home. It was just a quick walk between Sabbath school and church, but the yellow tulips brought me up short. Stunned, I regarded them nodding at me from the orderly arrangement among the order of Edith's yard. She continued, tears came as I recall whose hands lovingly placed these bulbs in the cool earth last fall. They probably never saw the trucks which hit them. The funeral was followed in heartbreaking succession. One by one, we laid them to rest under the bright blue autumn sky. The loved ones of the community stood in mute and tearful anguish on the soft grass. But then my mother writes these words, "But one bright, shining morning when the piercing trumpet call of the resurrection will pierce their sleep, waking them, they will arise in beautiful and more radiant shining, as surely as the yellow tulips in Edith's yard. So will my four friends, slumbering peacefully in the earth, arise to bloom eternally in beauty and radiance." One of my favorite Jewish rabbis wrote this short little vignette. He had raised up a group of believers in northern Greece. And they said, "Wait a second, what happens when you die? We've had some deaths. Is there any hope?" And he wrote, he says, "I do not want you to be ignorant concerning those who have fallen asleep." There's that word again. "Unless you sorrow as others who have no hope. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." That's my hope. That's our hope. The Bible speaks elsewhere of little details. I can imagine that day. I want to be there on that resurrection day. As the atmosphere seems to peel back and the sky is filled with millions of bright, luminous beings, at the very center of those beings is one who is coming, who has power, and who told Martha long ago, "I am the resurrection." And as the earth reels and rocks, I believe that at some point he will say, the Bible says it, he will call out, not "Lazarus, come forth," but "Awake, you who sleep in the dust, get up, arise." And I can imagine my mom waking up and thinking, "Wait a second. This isn't Palomar Medical Center, is it? Where am I? What time is it? Boy, do I feel good." And looking down, she said, "Wait a second, where are those age spots and the wrinkles? They're gone. Oh, I don't have any more pain in my body. I feel great." And I know what she's going to be doing. Well, you know what she's going to be doing at the very moment, the very next thing. She's going to be looking around, looking for her kids. And I don't just mean those of us who are biologically related. I mean any one of us who she loved and cared for. And you know, she's lived her life, she's made her decisions, her choices, and she's resting. Now is a time that I'm passionate about making sure that I have a connection with the one who is the resurrection. And I would just encourage you, this is not a big thing, but would you commit to at least exploring that possibility if you haven't before? That is our hope. That is our hope.